Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Adrian Cho, top global innovator, author, and musician. Adrian, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you also to Alex, both of you, for your interest in my work.
Now, Adrian, you've got this really remarkable background. I mean, it's quite unique. And kind of delving into this then, what are the parallels between the worlds of business and arts?
Well, I think in recent years, there have been two powerful movements in the world of business. One is that creativity is increasingly valued, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is simply that creativity is part of the innovation process, and we're being forced to innovate more in response to an increasingly complex and chaotic world. The other is that a lot of routine work is becoming less important due to increased automation and relocation of the work to lower cost markets. Dan Pink wrote an interesting book called The Whole New Mind, and in it he talked about how people who want to be in demand and valued as contributors need to be right-brained creative thinkers. So that's one aspect of it, is the creativity. And then the other thing that's, I think, interesting, and that's one that perhaps people don't realize so much, is that of the concept of continuous performance. Over the years, execution and project management has been moving from highly structured, formalized approaches to approaches that are freer and looser and don't rely so much on control and trying to predict everything, but rely more on doing things in smaller chunks and trying to adapt along the way. So this has often been seen as the agile movement, and then more recently as the continuous delivery movement. And when you look at artists, they understand clearly both creativity, but also this notion of real-time performance, because they're constantly in situations in which they are having to integrate the contributions and efforts of individuals and work it into a combined effort from a team and do it in real time. And in fact, they also have to do it on time as well. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when artists, for example, stage a performance, and they stage it for a scheduled time, no matter what happens, as they say, the show must go on, right? And then when they're actually in the act of performing, they have to do it in real time. They don't have the luxury of stopping to deal with problems or to clarify things. And more so, even artists that work in improvised art forms, such as jazz musicians, have to actually exercise their creativity in the moment, again, in real time. You know, for example, a composer that is writing music for a classical ensemble sort of has the luxury of being able to pre-compose or to write the script for the musicians beforehand, whereas jazz musicians don't have that luxury. They actually have to do all of this in the moment. So, you know, to me, when we look at where the world is going, the way in which people are trying to work, it's pretty clear to me that these are things that these are skills and understanding that artists have today. And so I really think that therefore people in the business world can learn a lot from artists.
So what are your top best practices for managing complex, globally distributed, agile software development projects?
I like to focus more on what I call fundamental principles rather than best practices. And the reason for that is that I believe there is actually, in fact, a danger to best practices, because, you know, what may work well in some situations, what may actually seem to be the best at one point in time, may actually turn out not to be the case when things change. But five of the things that I feel are pretty important is, one is this concept that I call lead on demand, which is really about decentralizing leadership and empowering anybody within a team or within an organization to be able to take the initiative, whether it's simply to stand up and say, you know, there's a problem, we should stop doing things this way, or perhaps to improve things, or to make people aware of something that they may not already be aware of. Another is the concept of embracing diversity and using that as a means to mitigate risk, to build teams that are very balanced, that have a lot of coverage, and that are strong. The third would be a concept of innovating and improvising. And actually, I sort of put this into the three I's. There's innovating, improvising, and iterating, because you do these things continuously over and over. And, you know, those skills are clearly important because, you know, you have to innovate to come up with solutions to complex problems, to unique solutions to complex problems. And you often have to improvise because you have to come up with these solutions at times when you may not expect it or in situations where you may not expect it. The other two fundamental principles, one is what I call making contributions count. So I often talk about Miles Davis in this context. He was a jazz musician, a trumpet player, very famous in the world of jazz, who played in a style that was very sparse. And he often had other musicians that he played with who played, you know, more notes and were more prolific in what they said. But, you know, even though Miles said less, he didn't say any less in terms of quality. It was no less compelling. And I think in many cases there are a lot of people who talk a lot, write a lot, and it doesn't always necessarily equate to more. In software, for example, you know, writing more code is not necessarily a good thing. It usually takes more memory. It takes longer to execute. It's more code to debug, more code to maintain, and so forth. So the idea of being as efficient as possible, I think, is one that's very important. And then the last one is this idea of increasing engagement. And that's really important both within a team and outside a team. You know, in order to increase collaboration within a team, you have to be very engaged in what is going on within the team and not just operating within your own individual workspace. And then to be very aware of what is happening in the market and what is happening, you know, amongst your consumers as well as your competitors, if you have any. You know, you have to be very aware of what is going on in those spaces as well. So these are all principles that I feel are very important. And obviously, you know, to actually implement these things, you have to introduce some practices, which may be best practices at a specific point in time. But it's the principles themselves that I think that are fundamentally important.
You know, earlier we talked about this whole aspect of arts and business, and, you know, you have this incredible music background. Can you describe some of this music background and how it assists your ICT work?
Well, yes, I think, you know, if I was to try and put it in a nutshell, I think there are two things that I feel are important when I... And I'm reminded of these things constantly, no matter which domain I'm in. I think when I'm playing music, I often find myself thinking about work situations, and when I'm in work situations in information technology, I often am thinking about music. And I think the two things that really come home to me more than any other, one is the concept of listening. I think, as I was saying before, in terms of saying a lot, you know, a lot of people say too much, write too much, whatever it may be, and really don't listen enough, that their awareness is not really as great as it should be. And listening is obviously a highly important skill in music. You have to listen to yourself in order to adjust your own contributions, whether it's even something so simple as playing a single note in tune. And you clearly have to listen to the combined results of the ensemble that you're playing in. And that is really the way that you have to measure and adjust, your own contributions, because, you know, doing something solo is very different to doing it, within a team or ensemble context. And I think the other thing is that, it's really the idea of selflessness, or, you know, lack of ego. And it's really the realization, the priority that the goals of the team are always more important than the goals of any one individual. And you can, it's interesting because in music, you know, both of these things are things that it's very easy to show the sort of the negative results, right, when you don't do these kinds of things that are important. If you don't listen, or if you go off on your own, or you play louder than everyone else, or you're not in time with everyone else, not synchronized with everyone else, the results in music are, obviously usually pretty disastrous. And, they're less so in a business context, at least that's the way it may appear to some people. But, the impact of not paying attention to these kinds of things is quite substantial, and especially if everyone is doing it, if everyone in a team or an organization is not listening, for example, that can be a really problematic thing.
There's this thing, the jazz process that you develop. So what are the key attributes of the jazz process, this execution-oriented framework for collaboration, innovation, and agility that can help teams in any domain improve their performance?
So I really packed a lot into the jazz process. The idea is conceptualized in 14 principles, but there are some that I think are particularly important. One is the idea of building trust and respect. That is clearly very important in order to execute in a high performance manner. You have to have trust there to be able to take risks. You have to have respect for other people's contributions if you want to welcome those and encourage those. The second thing is the idea of acting transparently. This is a very critical thing for execution. When in music, for example, when you're on the bandstand and you're playing jazz, for example, you only have microseconds sometimes to figure out what is going on, right? And you're operating in an environment where everything you're doing, or a lot of what you're doing, depending on the style of music you're playing, is unplanned. And so when someone does something, you have moments to react. And the thing is that if you operate in a way that makes it hard for other people to discern what you're doing, that makes execution very difficult. Another thing I think that's interesting is the idea of maintaining momentum. And this is really, in music, this is really comes forth in the concept of rhythm, which as you can imagine is everywhere in music. But rhythm is such an important thing also in many other activities, whether it's software development or any other kind of business activity. Most projects, for example, have a form or a structure to them, whether it's something that's only 3 minutes long, or it's a 3 month project or a 5 year project. They always have some kind of form and they have some kind of structure to them with checkpoints, and this then breaks down into a more detailed form of rhythm that you could almost even call a groove, where most teams, for example, typically have regular meetings or tasks or things that they do on a very regular basis, and maintaining that rhythm is so important for people to work together. And many people, many teams are get into a bad habit of just saying, well, we missed it this time, so we'll just be late. And this happens a lot, and that can cause a lot of problems. It makes it very hard for people to work together, and it also makes it very hard for consumers, for customers to hook into what vendors or producers are doing. Another thing I think that's very important in the jazz process is this idea of maintaining health or staying healthy. Health is something that is, it's an obvious thing when it comes to ourselves, our own bodies, and as well as our mental, our spiritual health, but it's also a concept that you can think about in organizations and in projects. And health is an interesting thing, because of course we know that when you get sick, if you don't tend to the sickness, it can get worse. It becomes a spiral effect in which you may get into a situation where to use the health analogy, the physical health analogy, taking some rest or getting over the counter drugs may not help anymore, and you may have to in fact go to the hospital. And so health is something that in jazz we're constantly aware of, because we're taking a lot of risks and it could possibly destabilize things, and so we're highly attuned to what the overall health is of the combined output of the team, and no matter what we do, we always maintain that as a priority to ensure that things stay stable and in good form. And then the last thing I think that's a key attribute of the jazz process is this idea of reducing friction. And friction is actually it's obviously a physical force, but it has many analogies and many forms. There are many forms of friction in most activities, and it really comes down to von Clausewitz. Actually was the Prussian military strategist who wrote about friction in his book on war, and he talked about friction as being all these little things that don't seem like much of a problem until you actually try to do them a lot, right? And most people in their day-to-day work have things that cause them friction. There are processes, there are interactions between people and so forth. And especially when you're working, for example, in a large team or a large organization or a very distributed, dispersed team, these kinds of things, simple interactions, right, when you're forced to do things over email and so forth, and maybe you don't get to speak on the phone or you don't get to have face-to-face interactions, all of these things cause friction, and they have to be reduced. And it's the kind of thing that we sort of live with every day in a lot of situations, and we just put up with it, and we just think this is the way that it has to happen. But when these kinds of things are optimized, or sometimes even reduced or eliminated entirely, they can make a huge, huge difference in execution.
So this is an extension to the prior question, and this is about your book. You know, you have this book, The Jazz Process: Collaboration, Innovation, and Agility. So what are some of the top lessons that you can share from this book?
Well, as I said, the jazz process is comprised of these 14 principles, and I discuss them all in detail in the book. And each principle has a chapter of its own. But there's also a special chapter in the book that's sort of jammed between chapters 5 and 6, and it's called Essentials of Execution. And it actually caused some consternation with my publisher, because they couldn't sort of figure out why I had this chapter in the middle of the book, and it didn't have a number. But it's actually arguably the most important chapter in the book, and it discusses a lot of the very important fundamental principles about execution, including the idea of feedback loops and how they are present in almost every living and human-made system that exists. In that context, it talks about the research of a guy named Colonel John Boyd, who was a fighter pilot and a aerial combat instructor and an aircraft designer. And many of his ideas have been discussed by management experts such as Tom Peters, and his ideas have also been used in military campaigns like Desert Storm. And so that book that chapter is really about a lot of it is about Boyd's idea of the OODA, observe, orient, decide, act, OODA loop, and it's a feedback loop that he researched and documented, and that he believed is very applicable to most almost anything that we do. And in his case, it was all about trying to maintain agility or get the advantage, or ultimately to win in an aerial combat situation in a dogfight. And it's interesting. His nickname was actually 40 Second Boyd, and as in 40 seconds the amount of time. And they called him that because he had this standing bet in which he bet, well, it was actually $40 at the time. Also, he bet that he could be in a position in the skies where he would be in front of another aircraft, and within 40 seconds he could maneuver to the position at the rear where he would be behind his opponent and able to execute the kill shot. And you can imagine in that kind of situation, that's a very critical situation where your life is on the line, right? You basically have this opportunity to either win or lose, and if you lose in that situation, you actually end up dead. But he really understood the whole concept of agility. For him, it was in the skies, but it turns out that his principles are very applicable to many other domains. And so this whole idea of executing is so very important, I think, because especially in business, it's very common that strategies are forged, and ultimately when they are put into to operation, we find that we can't execute on them for various reasons. So that's one. Another thing is that in the book I warn about the danger of relying on best practices, and this is something I mentioned earlier. And in fact, I even discussed the risk of applying the very principles in the book that I write about too extremely. Taichi Ono, who is known as the father of the Toyota production system, which later led to the lean manufacturing movement, had some very interesting things to say about this. And effectively what he said was that standards or best practices effectively are things that need to be changed constantly with the goal of continuous improvement. So the problem with best practices is that, as I said before, you know, they may be the best way of doing something, but once things change, they may no longer be the best way. And so if you rely on them naively, without considering when they should be improved or discarded, then you may be headed for trouble. Another thing that I think is important in the book is, which I sort of, I think in one sense justifies the approach of the book, is the belief that we can learn from other domains, and it's not just arts. I mean, the book is called The Jazz Process, and it relates a lot to what jazz musicians do, but it uses a lot of other examples from sports and military operations and, other domains. And so I believe that, there are many opportunities for us to learn, and in other domains and in the world around us. I mean, there's even a lot when it comes to collaboration. For example, I see collaboration at work all the time in many domains, in many disciplines, in commerce and recreation, and even in nature. I can watch the way a pack of wolves or a pride of lions or a colony of beavers work together, and those are lessons for me in collaboration. Perhaps I learn from the success or from the failure of it. Either way, it's a chance to learn, and I think that's really an important thing. I think in many domains, people are somewhat naive in believing that it's only they that understand a particular way of working. But in fact, many of the principles of working together, of innovating, of acting with agility are applicable across many domains. The other thing which I mentioned briefly before is this idea of awareness, and I discuss in the book the importance of awareness on a multitude of levels: individual awareness, team awareness, in which you're aware of what your collaborators are doing, and also situational awareness, where you're aware of what your consumers and competitors are doing. And awareness is really one of the most highly important abilities and skills, I think. Phil Jackson, who is a NBA basketball coach, has written a lot about awareness and really understands the importance of it in the sports domain, in basketball for him. But it's something, as I've talked about in music, it's very clearly manifested in the skill of listening. Every day, I think we actually even see examples of people who are not aware. Some people don't have a strong individual awareness. You can sometimes see, for example, you're driving down the road and you see someone who's driving along and their indicator is flashing, but they have no intention to turn, right? Then they just keep driving along like that for 2 or 3 minutes without realizing it. And clearly the person doesn't have very good individual awareness. And using the same analogy, you arrive, for example, at an intersection, an all stop intersection, and someone doesn't stop. They just go straight through the light and almost cause an accident, right? And then that's someone who doesn't have very good situational awareness. And these kinds of things are very important in collaborative contexts, because you need to be very aware of what you're doing and the value, by doing something, there's some value that you bring, and it's going to cause some impact, and it's going to require some effort, and you really need to understand that and understand what the impact is on the team's combined effort. And then I think maybe the last thing is really that in the book I write a lot about the what people I guess would call the soft side of things. So to me, success, and especially success in teams, is really about people. As individuals, we're human, we make mistakes, and we're subject to all kinds of tendencies and biases and quirks about that affect how we operate. And many of these things, in fact, can be amplified in group situations. There's the idea of groupthink, for example, where people will often collectively go down a path that is actually the wrong path, but they all do it together as a group because in some cases, for example, someone may actually think perhaps that there might be a problem of taking a certain approach, but they won't speak up or say anything about it because they feel that, perhaps they won't be listened to, or that maybe they don't think that their opposition is really valid in the face of the group. And ultimately, collaboration is really all about interactions between people. So all these kinds of things like trust, respect, selflessness, these are all very important qualities that are fundamental to success. And I think people are too quick to lend greater priority to concrete things that are easier to grasp. So things like domain-specific skills such as tools and technology and specific processes, all of these things are important, but they're not as important as the more general skills. And in fact, if you can be strong in these general skills, they're the kinds of things that are readily transferable to any other domain. So if you're changing roles, if you're changing jobs, and you can be good at these kinds of things, you can be successful in other fields.
Now, we've already discussed some of these topic areas, but I want to get your added recommendations for each of these areas, such as collaboration, innovation, agility, intellectual property, open development, jazz performance, and history.
So collaboration, let me try and then hit some of these briefly. So collaboration, I think three things that are important. One is listening. B is the idea of exchanging and having dialogue, exchanging ideas and having conversations with other people. So it's not, that's sort of a second step beyond listening. It's also having a continuous exchange of ideas and information. And then C is something I already hit on, which is valuing the team's goals above your own. So listening, exchanging, and dialoguing, and then valuing the team's goals above your own. For innovation, I think there's a few things. One is that innovation is or can be seen as a process of divergent and convergent thought. This is actually a concept that I write about in the book. It was developed by a guy named Joy Paul Guilford, who was an American psychologist who served in the U.S. Army during World War II. And it's the idea that you think divergently, you try to generate many solutions to a problem, and then you try to converge on the single best solution from that set of solutions. So that's one thing, is just to simply to understand the process of that and how various things such as diversity can affect both the divergent and the convergent phases of innovation. The second thing is that innovation is something that rarely happens in isolation. A lot of people, we often talk about inventors or specific people who invented something, and often it turns out that behind that single person are many other people, right? Or that person learned from others, maybe even people who lived before that person. Scott Birkin, who endorsed my book, The Jazz Process, had wrote a great book called The Myths of Innovation, and in there he discussed this myth of what we call the lone inventor, this idea that invention happens alone in isolation when it really doesn't. And that's why, in fact, collaboration and this exchange of information, the dialogue, is so critical. And then the third thing I think in innovation is that, quite simply, it's something that's very hard. I mean, people talk about it, companies talk about it constantly, but it's something that's extremely hard. It's become increasingly harder as the world becomes faster and more complex, and so it's not a simple thing at all. Agility. Well, I feel that especially in software development circles, agility or the whole concept of agile is something that is talked about a lot, almost to the point that there's almost this, I call it a cult of agile that has developed. And I call it that because there are a lot of people that, that claim to be agile because they use so-called agile tools or agile processes, often that are in fact sold to them by producers of those things, right? Vendors that produce the tools or consultants that hawk the processes. And in many cases, though, even though teams or organizations or individuals may use all of these things or employ them in some way, they often, in fact, don't turn out to have any agility at all. In software development, there is a very important event about 11 or 12 years ago where some notable people, critical thinkers, wrote something called the Agile Manifesto. And this was sort of seen as the start of the movement of agile software development. And recently, I think it was in February 2011, they did a sort of a 10-year retrospective of agile. And one of the things that they observed was exactly this, that there are a lot of people who think that they're agile because they're going through all of the motions of doing this, but they're actually really don't have agility. So that's one thing, is to be aware of that. The second is that, if you want to have an agile organization, you have to have an organization in which everyone is agile, right? It's almost like you can only be as agile as your slowest team member, and so it can't happen in silos. It has to happen throughout an entire organization. And the other thing is, I think that agility is highly important. And I think a lot of people realize this, but perhaps in some cases they don't understand why. And one of the reasons why simply is that sometimes getting to market first, even with something that is substandard, perhaps something that you may not even be proud of as your best work, may actually be the best approach in the long run if you can capture and retain market share or mind share. Getting there first may be more important than trying to do it so well that you get there last, because by the time you get there, it may simply not matter. Let's see. So intellectual property, I think this is like innovation. This is something that's very hard. I mean, we live in an increasingly complex world where intellectual property matters a lot, and we can see what's happening today in the information technology industry, for example, with all the litigation that's going on. I would say, it's a very complex field, and if you're not sure about something, then check on it with your attorney. And so I would say that is actually such an important thing. I'd say that twice. So that would be your two and three there for intellectual property. Open development, I think, so a few things. One is that transparency is the first step in open development, and transparency is something that people expect a lot nowadays. We not only as consumers want to know about something, what it is, but also how it was produced, right? We want to know, for example, that a company that produced something did it in a manner that was ecologically sound, for example. We want to know, where the raw materials came from or where the labor was done, et cetera. And that kind of thing gives people comfort, and it often satisfies their curiosity as well. The other thing is that, beyond that, transparency is sort of the first step, but a second step is really engaging. Just because you do things openly, it doesn't mean people will give you the feedback and engage in the kind of discussions that you really want to have. It takes a lot of effort to do that, a lot of cultural shifts within an organization. And then I think the third thing is that openness is really a very key thing to improve collaboration within a team and also with customers.
And then you have any added recommendations on this jazz performance and history?
Oh, yes, sorry. I think one is that, for jazz, you really just have to get in there and do it. It's the kind of thing which you can talk about in theory as much as you want, but there's no substitute for actually doing it. The second thing is that jazz is very much about saying yes a lot. And what I mean by that is actually that this is sort of a principle that has been written about or talked a lot about in the world of improvisational theater or improvisational comedy, and that is that when you have people up on stage performing some improv skit and someone says something like, I'm a doctor, the other person can't simply say, no, you're not, right? They have to, if they really want to help produce something that is in a comedic sense funny, right, or something that's going to be successful in some way, they have to accept what the other person is offering up, and that it's actually in fact called an offer in that domain or in that discipline. And you take the offer and you accept it and you build on it. And that, what that really translates to is that you have to be open to what other people are offering. And in fact, often when you do this in real time in jazz, you don't actually get even the opportunity to sort of to tell them to take it back. They can't do that, right? It's already out there now. So the thing is, what are you going to do with it, right? Are you going to ignore it, or are you actually going to try and do something with it? And when you try and do something with it, when you respond to the idea, for example, maybe you take it and repeat it and you perhaps vary it in some way, you're actually helping then to build something. And then I think the third thing is really, and you know, and I've mentioned this before, but there's really just nothing more important than listening. And the listening is not just also, it's not just the real-time listening that happens within the ensemble when you're playing music, but it's also the listening that you do, listening to recordings and studying everything that came before you, right? A lot of the great jazz musicians have built on what they studied from people who came before them, and that's sort of really what you're taught, is you're taught to learn from others, right, and incorporate their vocabulary and their ideas into your own.
Now, throughout this interview, you've talked about this whole concept of agility and sort of the context of agility and its importance. So if we could sort of expand that in a sense, can you share your views on the why and how of business agility?
Yeah, I think businesses are becoming increasingly aware that they need to be more agile. We live in a world of a lot of confusion, chaos, and conflict, and the agile response to that is, and I mentioned this before, is what I call these three I's. And so actually I also mentioned there the three C's. So you have confusion, chaos, and conflict, and the agile response is to innovate, to improvise, and to iterate. And you iterate because you do those things constantly. You're innovating, trying to come up with these unique solutions to problems, and you're improvising because you're just having to do things when you don't expect them to. So I think companies realize this, but you know, not surprisingly, especially large companies are finding it very difficult to gain agility. It's the kind of thing that requires huge, for many organizations, especially large organizations, requires huge cultural shifts, and it has to begin with people both at the top and at the bottom, and it has to ultimately. And I say that because, as I said before, a lot of strategies are formulated, and they're formulated without really considering the execution. And so when you have everybody in an organization who is involved in helping to formulate strategies, you know, and maybe for some people at the bottom of an organization, that's simply being given the opportunity to comment on something, right? So they hear what the vision is, and then they should be able to provide feedback on it. And that ensures that ultimately, hopefully, you end up with a strategy that is something that you can actually execute on. So I, you know, in summary, on the business agility, I think it's something that is just extremely hard to do and really requires a lot of cultural shifts.
Now, continuing on this sort of business theme, then what can business people learn from practitioners in other domains, such as the arts, sports, and military operations?
So, yeah, a lot of people are surprised when I talk about these kind of parallels. To me, they're actually pretty obvious. You can think of a number of things that go on. If you think about each of these activities, you think about, for example, musicians playing jazz, or you know, a team of people playing basketball, or a team of commandos in a military operation, right? What are all of these individuals doing, or what are these teams all doing at the same time? One is that they are all continuously integrating, and in fact, this idea of continuous integration is something that is talked a lot about in software. And in software, it's the idea of continuously building, taking all of the code that people write and bringing it together and building something. And you do that continuously, or you try to do it as continuously as possible. And that is, in fact, what is happening in all those kinds of, all those different domains, right? There are individuals who are each doing their own thing, and then somehow it has to come together and be combined to produce something that is the result of all of integrating all those things together. The second thing is that in the process of doing that, ultimately you hope that there is synergy present, meaning that the sum of putting all those individual contributions together is greater than each of the individual contributions alone. So if you take music, for example, if you were to have, you know, 100 people in a symphony orchestra each play their parts separately, it's not that interesting, right? But when you put them all together and they play them all together at the same time, that is something that can be compelling. And so you hopefully have that synergy in anything that you do, and it's something that can be present in any of those domains. Another thing is this idea of feedback, and that's also a continuous thing as well. So constantly, as people are operating in those different domains as individuals, they are assessing their own success and using that as feedback into their ongoing operation of what they do. They are looking at gaining feedback from everything that the team does collectively and figuring out, okay, this is how we sound together, or this is how we perform together, and perhaps as a result we need to change these things or tweak these things. And then they're also soliciting feedback from what is happening outside of their team domain, from, for example, whoever might be consuming their product or their service. You know, when I, as a jazz musician, for example, when I'm on stage, I mean, I look out there in the audience, right? And this is sort of going back also to what I mentioned about feedback before. About awareness. This is why awareness is so very important, right? And when people are good at when people are highly skilled at something, right? They're highly skilled practitioners. That is beneficial not only because they're just simply good at what they can do, whether it's writing or playing music or you know, playing sports or whatever it may be. The more important thing is that if they're good at something, it enables them to actually do a lot of what they do with less attention or effort. You know, there are things that we all do, for example, in our day-to-day work that are things that we can often do on autopilot, right? And that's useful because it actually gives us cycles, brain cycles effectively, to be able to think about other things. So you can imagine as a musician, for example, if I am just, you know, if I have to concentrate, if I have to spend 100% of my concentration thinking about how to play the instrument, where I put my hands, and all the little things that I need to do physically, I have nothing left over to be able to be aware of what is happening within the team and what is happening in the room with the audience and how they're responding and so forth, right? So I need to be good enough that I can do all of those things, just playing notes and so forth on autopilot, so that I can be very aware of what is happening out there and around me. Another thing that is very present in all of these domains is that there's a need for high quality. Right, we talk about in software, for example, bugs, you know, defects, right? That's a measure of quality or lack of quality. But it's pretty obvious that high quality needs to be there in, for example, a music performance. If you imagine, for example, like 100 musicians in a symphony orchestra playing, you know, if they each play 1,000 notes in a night, right? That's 100,000 notes. And if just 5 of those notes are wrong, especially at the wrong time, it could completely ruin a performance. In really critical situations, such as military situations, the quality clearly needs to be there, right? Mistakes, defects, bugs, whatever you want to call them, could actually be life-threatening or cost lives. And then two final things that I think are present in all of these domains, and I talked about these before, is one is this, the concept of being able to deliver on time, right? For many of these practitioners, when they say they're going to do something on this date, this time, that's when they have to do it. They don't have the luxury of saying, oh, something happened, so let's just cancel the performance, right? Let's just delay the performance. You can't do that because people already bought tickets, for example, right? And so you just have to go ahead and do it no matter what happens. And you just have to find a way to do it. You have to improvise if that is what's required. The other thing is as I mentioned before, this idea of real-time delivery. So there's on-time delivery and then there's real-time delivery. And the real-time delivery is that you have to do it in the moment. There is no stopping, right? You have to just, when you start, you have to proceed and you have to do it continuously, and there's just simply no stopping. And that's the way it actually should be in a lot of cases for business. A lot of people create the luxury of stopping and delaying things and so forth, and really need to get more into the mode of just saying, okay, no, we simply just move on and we figure out how to adapt as we go.
Now, throughout our discussion, you've already sort of talked about this idea of diversity and the need for it. And I just want you to give me some more details on what is the value of diversity in building teams.
Sure. Well, I think it's interesting to start by talking about what happens when you don't have diversity. So I think there's actually a convention of building teams without prioritizing diversity, and people build these what I call meritocracies as opposed to meritocracies, right? And a meritocracy, it's just a made-up word, but it really sort of means that you build an organization by or a team by hiring people who have similar skills and experience as yourself, right? It seems like a natural thing to do. But the sort of extension of that, the evolution of that, is that then you tend to promote people who agree with you. You ignore questions and concerns that are opposing to your own. Maybe you suppress those ideas. And what happens is that often in a attempt to get to somewhere quickly, and of course speed is often of the essence nowadays, you force an early consensus, and then you claim success, right? Because you think you got to the right place, but in fact, perhaps you even actually fail, right? You actually end up in the wrong place. You found the wrong solution, because you didn't have diversity within the team. So diversity is something that has a lot of benefits, right? I talked about synergy before, right? Synergy is more likely to be present when there's diversity. You think about, for example, a jazz band, right? If you've got five people in the band all playing the same instrument, the synergy is less likely to be there than if they are playing different instruments, bringing different things to the team's effort. Diversity is very important in innovation. I talked before about divergent and convergent thinking. There was actually a very interesting study that was done where they studied 500,000 patent inventions, and they looked at how diversity affected both divergent thinking, that is generating solutions, as well as selecting the solution, selecting the best solution. And in both cases, having diversity of experience or technical skill was very important to getting to the best place. So it has a real critical effect on innovation. The other thing is diversity is it's a well-known technique of risk mitigation in finance, for example, right? You diversify your portfolio. You don't put everything in the one basket, because that can expose you to problems. So there are many benefits, and I think in staffing teams, people need to think about diversity, and they need to value individuality, and they need to actually seek out the outliers. And this is one of the reasons that jazz for me is such a good analogy, because in jazz we really value individuality, right? We actually look for people that bring something new, and jazz musicians are constantly building new teams and seeking out new people to try and do new and interesting things. And it's actually interesting if you sort of contrast the sort of classical way of things to the jazz way of things. And, you know, I mean, there are some stereotypes to this, but there's also definitely a lot of truth to it too. I mean, even if you look at symphony orchestras today, what do you see? You know, you see a lot of conformance, right? It's even apparent even in the racial makeup of some of these groups, right? They're predominantly, at least in the West, they're predominantly white, for example. And you look at the way they play, often people are not selected to play in a symphony orchestra because they don't conform to the way things are done. And often you'll see, for example, people, all the violins, for example, in the first violin section may, in some cases, often all be bowing. Their bows are all moving exactly the same way because it's deemed to be that is the only way that it's done, right? Everyone has to do it together, which is not necessarily always the case. So seeking out the outliers is something that is really important. It builds balance and it builds health, right? You want people, for example, who are good at starting things and people who are good at finishing things, and most people are not good at both of those things. You want people who are risk takers, who have an appetite for risk, and you want people who are adverse to risk. You want people who tend to, you know, to rush, but you also want people who won't rush. You know, you think about a band, for example, if all of the musicians tend to play in front of the beat or ahead of the beat or tend to rush the beat, if everybody like that is in the band, then not surprisingly, the whole band will rush, right? You actually want people who will sort of balance that out. You can actually see this in a jazz band often. You know, I play bass and sometimes I play with a drummer, and perhaps maybe in some cases the drummer might tend to rush ahead and then I will try and pull them back, right? And that's sort of the balance, the counterbalance. You want people who will initiate change, but you also want people who are willing to say, you know, perhaps we should stay with the status quo. That is actually useful in some cases. And you also want, as I mentioned before, this concept of how much you say. You want people who are prolific, but you also want people who can say more with less. And so I think it's really important to have a balance of all of these things. And so you can think about diversity in so many across so many aspects.
You know, it's an interesting concept, diversity in teams, but where does it become chaos, where the management of the diversity becomes a distraction?
Yeah, I think, you know, that I mean, as I said before, this is sort of one of the reasons why a lot of things that I talk about in the Jazz Process book, at the end I talk about the risk of using any of these things in extreme. A lot of this stuff has to be balanced, and you have to think about how you put it into practice. But one of the things certainly is that, as I said before, ultimately people really need to be giving the greatest priority to the efforts and the combined results of the team and what happens in the team, right? And if something doesn't work, you have to make adjustments. But what I find, though, is that people tend to err on the other side, right? There's just simply a real lack of diversity, and they could actually do with injecting some of it in there, right? Of course, yes, if you have too much, it can lead to a chaotic situation, right? It's the kind of thing, for example, in discussions, right? It's easy to sometimes get to a solution very quickly if everybody just quickly agrees, right? But on the other hand, if you have so many diverse opinions, right, perhaps you can never come to an agreement at all, right? So you've got to find that balance.
So now on to maybe some broader issues. What do you see as the top challenges facing the ICT industry in 2013?
Well, that's a big question. I think, you know, right now certainly perhaps the biggest one is the economy. Things are definitely pretty tough financially. It's certainly affecting sales. There are, in some cases, some organizations, for example, are seeing greater number of transactions or increases in transactions. Perhaps they're just not really seeing the volume, right? So in other words, a lot of people are perhaps trying things, but they're not doing them on such a large scale, right? They're not willing to invest so deeply. Another thing is that clearly the geopolitical conflicts around the world are also very worrying, and I think that's also exacerbated by ever-increasing exposure to growth markets as organizations move things to other geographies, and geographies where potentially some of this conflict is taking place or is nearby. I think, you know, natural disasters are actually something that are always, you know, something that we often typically can't predict, but you can imagine a major event in some countries really could have a devastating effect on supply chains, and so obviously we hope that that doesn't happen. I think another thing is cyber security. I think there have been things certainly that have happened in the past, and we often find them in the news, but there are, I think, potential disasters waiting to happen there for hackers to exploit loopholes wherever they may be. And at the same time, there's increases in litigation, in policies and regulation that are increasing as a result of that. And obviously that costs money too. And then I think it's simply just getting to consumers and being able to convert to sales is becoming increasingly harder because consumers are really becoming more empowered within organizations. practitioners and not necessarily people at the top of the organization are becoming increasingly more influential in buying decisions, and a lot of companies don't realize that they are still selling to the people at the top, and in a lot of cases it's actually the people at the bottom who are having such a major influence on what is chosen. You know, we have this sort of idea of shelfware, right, where, for example, someone says, okay, let's use this, right, and someone at the top says, let's use this, and they make a major purchase decision, but basically the stuff never really gets used, right, it just basically sits on the shelf because people, you know, in the teams, people at the bottom of the organization try it and find that it just simply doesn't work for them, right, or they fail trying to use it.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up this sort of idea of, I guess, sort of the broader masses or the consumer, perhaps, or the consumer aspects of people out there. And I guess it brings also to mind then the sort of consumerization of IT, these sort of buzzwords, or bring your own device, and how that's kind of changing the mindset in the world today.
Yes.
Now, what are the top opportunities that you see for the ICT industry in 2013, sort of the opposite side of the coin, rather than the challenges? What are the opportunities?
Right. I mean, I don't sort of have any revelations here. I think a lot of the things that are the opportunities are things that are the opportunities today. I think, you know, social, for example, is something that's already pretty big, but it's just going to get bigger. A lot more will happen on social platforms, including sharing, content sharing, buying decisions, and so forth, right? I mean, that's where a lot of the stuff is happening now, right? And it's at places, too, that companies can't control so much, right? It's not happening on their website, right? It's happening in some other place, at some random place, and people have the freedom to be able to go out and do that. They can go to any place they want, whether it's Facebook or anywhere else, and write about something, complain about something, or say something is really great, right? And engage in discussions with other people about that. But I think companies that are able to take advantage of this and figure it out will do well. I think mobile technology is something that, again, is clearly, it's big today. It's just going to get bigger. And people want to be able to do more of the things that they do, you know, more often, more continuously. They want to be able to do stuff all the time and have access to things wherever they are. And that means not just consuming content, but it means doing work, right? They want to be able to not just look at a document. They want to be able to edit a document, for example, or share it and so forth. I think coupled with all of this is the cloud. It's being able to get your stuff from anywhere, being able to rapidly expand, you know, without all the traditional costs associated with the infrastructure, being able to do things with less friction. It should just be easier to do things, and companies that can take advantage of that, I think, will do well. I think, again, coupled with that is the network. The network is really the backbone to all of these things. It's, especially as work is increasingly distributed, the network plays a bigger and bigger role. And then I think the other thing is that, again, it's something that is already happening today, is this whole concept of smarter systems. We are increasingly trying to automate more things. We have more computing devices everywhere, in the home, in the car, et cetera. And we're just going to see more and more of that happen. So, you know, I think that's a big opportunity, especially, you know, there's talk of, you know, having robots in the workplace and all these kinds of things, right? And those are all opportunities for sure.
You pick up a paper or you watch some of the news feeds and you see all of these controversies in politics, for example, the fiscal cliff, you know, the negotiations occurring on in the U.S., at least in the fall of and winter of 2012, or on the internet, this whole concept of, is it going to be governed? Is there going to be some fees? And the ITU being involved in some of these discussions, and where is that going? Those are areas of controversy. Do you have any, what you consider to be areas of controversy in the areas that you work in?
Well, I think perhaps they are. I mean, some of the things I could describe are controversial, or at least I sort of see tension or friction there. One is actually, at least in the ICT industry, I think we're really definitely still not there in terms of sexual equality, right? Women really still don't have the opportunities, both in education and in the workplace. So I think that's something that really needs more work. I think I've talked about this idea of decentralizing leadership, what I call the leading on demand, right? And that is something that goes a lot of, against a lot of ingrained culture in organizations as well as within in societies. I think well, you mentioned it, the bring your own device movement. I think is something that is controversial, right? It's something that is moving very quickly, and employees in large organizations want to be able to do it, and the large organizations are finding it very hard to figure out how to manage it. I think I talked a little bit about friction and the idea of trying to eliminate frictional forces or at least reduce them, and that is something I think that it often introduces controversy or tension, right? Because, for example, people have ways of doing things, and sometimes we ask, why are we doing it this way? And nobody even knows, right? It's, well, the answer is sometimes, well, we've just always done it this way. And in fact, the way that we're doing it is actually a way that is very inefficient and is generating a lot of pain and grief and tension and friction, right? And but sometimes getting rid of these kinds of things or optimizing them is not easy at all. That often brings up a lot of controversy. And then I think the other thing is the trend towards redistributing the work globally is something that is controversial for many organizations. That's it.
You know, in business, there's this concept of a SWOT analysis, you know, where you determine the strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats, and those opportunities and threats could be external to the organization. Or you talked about this sort of idea of situational awareness, you know, what are the things going on around you that you need to be aware of. So let's broaden the concept of challenges now, and that what do you see as some of the top challenges facing the world, which people have to be aware of because it could affect them in their daily jobs?
Yeah, well, I think two of them I already mentioned. One is the economy. It's something that is affecting everybody. I think the potential conflicts or the conflicts that are happening in the world today, I think, is also something that people need to be more aware of. It's very easy to sort of ignore that stuff if it's not happening on the home front, but it actually has a lot of ramifications. And then I think another three would be ones that are really serious problems. And one is health. Global health, I think, is something that, a lot of people that live in countries where they have good access to healthcare really don't understand just how bad it is in other places where they don't have that. And, you know, as I've mentioned before, you know, without health, right, things can be very bad, right? And there's really no excuse for the kinds of situations that some countries are having to deal with today in terms of health, and that's something that really is a great challenge for the world. I think we are consuming resources at an absolutely alarming rate, and that is a big challenge, I think, for the world, the dwindling resources. And then I think another one is poverty, right? That is a situation that, again, like healthcare, and they are related, is something that is a very sad situation and really remains a huge challenge for the world to try and solve that problem.
You know, I recall a few years ago seeing sort of this news item about this concept of a new kind of phone that was going to be much more. And who would have guessed the impact it would have on the world? And you know, you have entire corporations failing because they couldn't keep up with sort of this disruptive change, or the impact of tablets and how it's shifting away from PCs, or just all of these kinds of things that are happening. You're a world expert. You're acknowledged and highly respected for all the work you've done worldwide. What do you see as some of the disruptive technologies coming up?
Well, I think a couple of them I already mentioned. One is, and you just mentioned it, right, is mobile technology, right? And it's interesting too. Star Trek, right, the phenomenon, and that, like, the early Star Trek TV series, right, was sort of foresaw this, right, and they had this personal communications device, right, that did all of these things, and that you could execute commands and talk to it and get information from, you know, anywhere, right? And yes, it's a reality nowadays, and of course those devices are becoming increasingly more powerful, and the computing is being distributed more increasingly across the planet, and we've got devices that were, you know, dumb 10 years ago but are now smarter, right? And we have microchips in everything, right? And so I think that is number one. Number two is what I already talked about, the cloud, but you know, the sort of the interface to the cloud is the browser, right? It's now possible to be able to do so much in the browser. It's not just that you look at text, right, or that you look at images, right, or that you even, you know, watch movies in the browser, right? You can actually do work in the browser, right? And so, you know, it's now becoming possible for people to just use a web browser and have nothing else. They don't even have to have anything else on their desktop, and they can use a browser, of course, from any device, right, phone or a tablet, and be able to do all of their work and have it all, you know, all of it saved in the cloud, every part of the state of their workspace. Three things I think that are really on the horizon. I mean, one is, well, you know, this is not a new thing, but we need to make dramatic leaps forward is in storage, right? We're very limited by storage today. And I remember reading something many years ago about holographic storage, and I'm not sure whatever happened to that, but that's, you know, we're still, you know, you go out there and you and are about buying, you know, a 32 gig or a 64 gig card or whatever to expand your device, right? And we just like to be able to have access to terabytes of storage easily. And what a difference that would make. Power, I think, is another thing that is potentially disruptive, right? We're very limited by power today, right? We all have these mobile devices, and we're constantly having to charge them all the time, and that is a big problem. And I think anybody that can make huge advances there is going to make a really big difference. And related to that is electric vehicles. Looking at what's happened with Tesla, I think it's quite amazing and impressive, and of course that is also linked to power. But one of the things that sort of blew my mind was the concept that an electric vehicle is something that is not only something that just doesn't use gas, right, doesn't have emissions, but could actually be a high performance vehicle, right? That's something that's really quite cool.
You know, I look around and I've spoken at different conferences, and you see this idea of computing as a profession, or some people want it to be a profession on par with accounting, medicine, law, and others, where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and perhaps even recognized credentials. What are your feelings about that? Should computing be a recognized profession on par with some of the others?
Well, I think, I think it's, in theory, it could be a good thing. What I think is that I find it hard to believe that we could actually regulate something that would be such a fast evolving discipline. I'm reminded of my early studies. When I went to university, I tried to go into an information technology course, and I tried the first year of it, and I found just how amazingly behind they were in the curriculum. I mean, they just simply couldn't keep pace with what was happening. And so I ended up leaving, and I never completed it because it just was not going to help me in any way. And I worry that, I can certainly see benefits of the kind of thing you're talking about, but it's, you know, I don't know how we do it in practice. I think it's very, very difficult.
Okay, we're down to our last question, and as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, you are a world-renowned expert. You speak worldwide. You've got a best-selling book. Your practices are used worldwide. You are a thought leader. So from all of your speaking, travels, and work, do you have something interesting to share in terms of a story? Maybe something amusing or surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Well, I don't know whether I can come up with anything that amazing, but I do have, let me think, there's sort of actually one story. This is a very, almost a silly story, and it's a very short story, but it's one that actually has stuck with me for a long time. And it was when I was working on a project, it was perhaps when I was about 19, and I was working on a project for some large company, and the project was not going well. Actually, I was working for a company that was providing services to another company, and the project was not going very well, and they brought in someone to try and make things better and get things on the right track. And this person was some highfalutin manager and got everyone in a room and basically pepped everyone up and talked about how, you know, we can do it, we can do it, we can do it, and if we think we can do it, we can do it, and think positive and so forth. And I, being very young and stupid and arrogant at the time, said something like, that makes no sense. And I partially was saying this also because I had sort of seen where the project was and the kinds of problems they were having in executing and the kinds of things that I've talked about in this interview. And I said, you know, if I jump out that window right now and I really, 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 really think that I can fly and I flap my arms, what do you think is going to happen? Now, of course, it was not a really great thing to say, and probably being a little bit more conservative today, I would not have said that, but I said it back then when I was not so or a lot more brash, and it actually got a huge laugh from everyone in the room. But of course, it was somewhat probably embarrassing for the person, and they didn't take it very well. And suffice it to say, I did not have my contract extended that on that project. But it's something that still stuck with me every day, because I still have seen in so many cases where people are just unrealistic and they really think that something will happen and that they will, you know, things will work out, right? And that, you know, as long as we work hard or as long as we think positive, everything will be fine. And perhaps that is sometimes true, but often it's not the case. And as things become more complex and as the world is turning effectively faster, it becomes much harder to just hope that things will happen, and you really have to work very hard at it and be hyper realistic about things and do things in a way that you really can truly execute and get things done. Because actually, you know, getting things done, getting things finished, getting it done on time, getting it done with high quality is extremely extremely difficult, and not many people really can do it well. So that's my story.
You know, your story is really quite interesting, because it kind of reminds me of this acronym called SMART, and that is that when you set goals, they should be specific and measurable, achievable, relevant, and with a time frame. And surrounding all of this is you have to execute. If you can't execute, it doesn't mean anything. So
yes.
Well, Adrian, again, thank you for coming in today. You are this world-renowned expert, and I know your schedule is very demanding, and our audience is going to get so many tips from all the many, many insights that you shared during this interview. So again, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. I really appreciate all the interesting questions.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Adrian Troll, top global innovator, author, and musician.